The following program is a presentation of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction.
As society moves more and more to plastic and electronic forms of commerce and entertainment, we're left with more and more ratty old paper, worth less and less and less, with some notable exceptions. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? I'm David Bluestein.
And I'm Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio.
We're here each Saturday morning at 7 o'clock to provide an insider's view on the world of jewelry, coins, antiques, collectibles, and so much more. As owners and operators of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction, we're on the front line with a finger on the pulse of these markets every day. And as of right now, you have a friend in the business. Which do you prefer, paper or plastic? Often, it just doesn't matter, except, well, sometimes. Today on our Insider Report, you'll get the inside story on ephemera. What's collectible in paper and what's not? Also, we'll be talking to David Astwood, local scripophilist from David Astwood Collectibles. I cannot believe I said script. See, I can't do it twice. Scripophilist. We'll be taking your calls and emails on the subject of ephemera, which is paper collectibles. You know, we have posted on our inthemoneyradio.com website the In the Money Facts of Life, 14 rules for buying and selling that applies to just about everything. Rule number one, nobody wants your smelly old junk. And, of course, some smelly old junk can be quite valuable. But, you know, basically, we're talking about the fact that so many people come to us at the Jewelry Exchange with old stuff and telling us, look how old it is. It must be very valuable because it's so old. And, of course, that's just not the case. We point to the rocks outside and comment how old those are and ask them how much they give us for those.
Yeah, some of the most expensive things we've sold at the auction weren't made that long ago. And then on the other side of that, we sell, for example, the Roman ancient coins that are over 1,000 years old, and those are going to sell for somewhere between $20 and $30 a piece.
Right. You know, so all the time people are bringing us old newspapers. We've sold Harper's Weeklies from the 1880s that have brought $5 or $10 a piece. And I don't want to see any more Kennedy assassinated newspapers. You know, it's a great example of when people think something might become collectible, they put it away, and then later everyone has one. And so how can it be collectible?
It's like the Kennedy half dollars.
Right. And I'm going to talk about the Kennedy half dollars in a little while when we do the trivia quiz. You know, old magazines and magazine ads, people used to rip magazine ads out of the old magazines and shrink wrap them. And I remember in the 80s, $2, $3, $4 a piece in the antique stores. Nobody wants that stuff now. Old National Geographics, everybody knows old National Geographic magazines are valuable. No, they're not. Life magazine, Look, Harper's Bazaar. And like I say, those shrink wrapped ads, we've actually tried them because I'm nostalgic for the old days when we used to get a few dollars each. Can't get that anymore. Old books. People bring us the smelliest, rattiest old books, thinking that they've got to be valuable because they're old. You know, we do fairly well with Bibles from the mid-1800s. They're cool. They're richly illustrated. Sometimes they have metal hardware, leather binding, and they just look nice. Old red books, coin catalogs, the Guide to United States Coins, the first five editions from the late 40s and the early 50s. They're collectible, but not the rest of them.
And Fact of Life, In the Money, Fact of Life number 8 comes into play a lot with the paper. Number 8 is condition matters. We see paper all the time that's been folded up and has water damage and there's mold and it's ripped up. And in that case, it's just, it can't be worth as much as a nicer example.
Yeah, and you know, remember Fun with Dick and Jane? Well, I do, but I just turned 60. Everybody else in here is saying, I don't know what you're talking about. that was the primer, the readers that we had in the 1950s. And people bring those to us, and they're written in, and they're ripped up a bittle. And people just assume that that nostalgic value is worth something. But, you know, we refer to In the Money Facts of Life number 2. If young people don't want it, then nobody wants it. The last thing a 60-year-old person is going to do is buy a buy a Fun with Dick and Jane book. And frankly, the last thing a 20-year-old person's going to do is buy a Fun with Dick and Jane book. Why would they want to do that? We like to refer to In the Money, Facts of Life number 11, too, that says, if it says collectible on the package, well, it's not collectible. And that's why when we talk about ephemera, you've got to talk about modern sports trading cards and modern comic books. We had Ted Yeer on from Ted's Collectibles a few weeks ago, and he commented on the quarter-cent rule. These baseball, football, basketball cards from the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and even more current, quarter-cent rule, which means when we sell them in a tub of 10,000 cards, $25, that's a quarter cent each. And frankly, we're happy to get $25 for those because everybody's got closets full of those. And they tend to think they're collectible because they must be. It says on the package they're collectible. And we refer to In the Money, Facts of Life number 9, that most valuables aren't rare. They're just well marketed. The entire hobby of collecting postage stamps. Isn't that funny? We're in the collectible business. And Adam, after 3 years at the Jewelry Exchange, how many people come to us with their stamp collections compared to how many people come with their coin collections?
There are very few stamp collections, and most of the ones I see are first day covers, which I know is the bottom of the barrel with stamp collections.
Well, when I was a kid, I was a coin collector and a stamp collector. Everybody I knew was. David asked what our guess is, shaking his head, yes. I mean, that's what we did. That's how we learned about the world. But stamps, just not anymore. And even, I mentioned the old red books, the old books with coin values. Well, the old Scott stamp catalogs for postage stamp values. I bought an entire library of those years ago, and I was shocked. Couldn't get more than a couple dollars each for them because the stamps are well marketed, but they're just not rare. They're just not valuable. You think about it. Ladies and gentlemen, they're pieces of paper, and they just printed millions and millions and millions of them.
And I think I heard you say something about the stamps can get about, you can get about 3% of the book value.
Yeah, a stamp has to be pretty old and in pretty nice condition. And when I say old, I'm talking, in this case, much rarer than the modern stamps, where they literally just print hundreds of millions of them. And, you know, probably what will come to as a surprise to auction consigners all over the United States, limited edition signed and numbered prints. I don't care, Norman Rockwell's, Andrew Wyeth, and don't get me started on Thomas Kincaid. People don't want those. People just don't want those. The top of the line, the rarest of the rare, is always in demand. But these, you know, one of 10,000, one of 1,000, people don't want them anymore. It's hard to recover the value of the frame. Lots of paper is very, very interesting. There are many bright spots in the ephemera market, and we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But we just wanted to run through that list of paper that you might have in your house that you shouldn't be too optimistic about, because we see a lot of it, and it's not going to be valuable. But before we get into the bright spots in the market, let's go to the trivia quiz. It's time for the In the Money trivia quiz, the weekly quiz where you win the answer. Before we get to this week's question, let's review last week's quiz. Adam?
Last week's question was another gemstone question. And there it is. This gemstone can take billions of years to form under the intense heat and pressure 100 miles below the Earth's crust and then pushed up to the surface by volcanoes. It's primarily made out of carbon, and it's the hardest material on Earth. What is it? Well, I think a lot of you knew that that it was diamond. That was the answer. Glenn Davis was the lucky winner. He put in the first answer. And his prize this week is a 1/2-carat round brilliant diamond. That's a genuine half a carat round brilliant diamond. And Glenn, I'm sure you want to come pick up your prize. come pick it up at Jewelry Exchange and Auction.
Not sure I want Glenn to come pick that up. You've only got 30 days, Glenn, and I'm counting.
And Glenn, come to Jewelry Exchange and Auction at the gallery at 19903 Stone Oak Parkway within the next 30 days to claim your prize. Our gallery is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and Saturday evenings for our live auction. For more information, please contact us from our website, jewelryexchangeandauction.com. That's jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And now for this week's quiz.
I got a good one this week. A little bit of a lesson first, because I think that you might find this interesting. I think most people don't know this. Yeah, it's about the Kennedy half dollar. Adam mentioned it earlier. You know, Kennedy half dollars were first minted in 1964 as a tribute to the fallen President Kennedy, who was assassinated in Dallas the previous year in 1963. Coincidentally, 1964 was also the last year that the U.S. government minted regular issue coinage in 90% pure silver. Up to that time, the dimes, the quarters, the half dollars, all 90% pure silver. And although the mint minted quantities of these Kennedy half dollars in 1964, quantities that are just too large that the coin could never really be collectible. It's so common. Still today, it has about $11 worth of silver in it. And as a side note, a small number of 90% silver Kennedy half dollars are also released each year in special proof sets made for collectors, but you're not going to find those in your change. So 1964, 90% silver Kennedy half dollars. Now, for the past few decades, Kennedy half dollars have been made of a copper nickel alloy called cupronickel, the same alloy that dimes and quarters are made out of too. And although you don't usually see Kennedy half dollars because they're not released in circulation, they're still minted in large quantities, and still they're not considered to be collectible. Chances are excellent that most, if not all, of those Kennedy half dollars that you have socked away in the back of your underwear drawer are probably spending money worth exactly 50 cents each. Don't save them. They aren't now, and they will never be worth more than 50 cents apiece. Which brings us to today's In the Money trivia question. Between the 90% silver Kennedy half dollar of 1964 and the cupronickel Kennedy half dollar of today, the United States Mint minted a third variety of Kennedy half dollar that was neither 90% silver nor copper nickel alloy. Today's question: during which years was this third variety of Kennedy half dollar minted, and what was its metal content? To be a winner, all you have to do is to be one of the first 10 people to email the correct answer to quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. You can also submit your answer directly from our homepage at www.inthemoneyradio.com. Then listen to next week's show to see if we read your name on the air. If we do, just come on up to the Jewelry Exchange in Stone Oak within the next 30 days. Enter as often as you like, but please only one winner per household per month. Remember the email address, quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. Good luck. Now let's take a short commercial break. Ordinarily, we play one of our canned commercials here. We've got a few good, informative commercials. We invite you to come up to the Jewelry Exchange and let's have some fun and let's do some business. But we've just got to tell you that we're just overwhelmed with the amount of merchandise, quality merchandise that we have. Last Wednesday and last Thursday, we sold over 700 pieces of nothing but silver James Avery jewelry, lots and lots of bargains. Tonight, that's in our Stone Oak Gallery at 7 o'clock. What do we have? I know we have 22 pieces of Tiffany jewelry.
There's a lot of David Yurman.
Some John Hardy. You know, I think I counted 102 pieces, more pieces of James Avery silver. And I think there's some gold and maybe some silver and gold. I think we have 9 pistols, 3 rifles. There's dozens of knives. We've got a really cool Texas Longhorn steer head. Bayonets and daggers, and I mean it just goes on and on, including lots and lots of coins. We have an 18th century United States silver dollar, and so much more. And you know what? Next week, next Wednesday, next Thursday, we have another 700 pieces of James Avery silver jewelry. Look, if you like James Avery, you have got to come and get to know us, because we're just selling it, ladies and gentlemen, and we've got a lot more coming too. Every Saturday night, 7 o'clock in Stone Oak at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. You know the Mormon Temple at the top of the hill? It's all lit up at night. And across the street from there is a McDonald's, a new McDonald's. We're on that same corner. Very easy to find. It's a friendly crowd. We have an off-duty uniformed police officer at the door. Come on up. There's not going to be any trouble. And you're going to get some bargains. And you don't have to register. You don't have to bid. The only rule is if you're a successful bidder, you got to pay for it, and then you take it home.
And all that James Avery is going to go for somewhere between 50% to 80% of retail.
Yeah, it's incredible. You can't believe it till you see it. All guaranteed to be authentic, genuine Sterling, genuine James Avery, genuine Tiffany, genuine David Yurman, guaranteed. Please come up and see us. I promise you that you're going to enjoy yourself, and you're going to get some great bargains too. Let's go to the Insider Report. We're talking today about paper or plastic ephemera, which is paper collectibles. And I mentioned some things during the intro. We talked about categories that are out or essentially out, old newspapers and magazines. Almost all old books are really just paper now. The information in the books, you get it online. You get it in digital form. Even old reference books are no longer valuable. We're shocked. Books that we cherished for decades, to have that information at our fingertip that nobody wants anymore. Even postage stamps and certainly limited edition signed numbered prints. You hear us harping about that all the time. But let's get positive now. What paper collectibles are in? What collectibles should be shown to an expert before you store them away, or even before you discard them? Well, plenty. And the number one category of collectible paper that we see every day is currency. I you could argue whether it really is ephemera or not, because really paper currency technically is scrip. It's not really money. It's paper that represents money. Mm-hmm. It's only recently that we look at it and say, oh, money, because believe me, it hasn't always been like that. When the United States started doing business in the 1700s, there was no paper money. There was circulating coins from other countries. There was no United States Mint. And slowly the individual colonies started to make paper money, and the federal government made some paper money. Today we call it continental currency. It goes back to the days of the Continental Congress. And it's kind of thick, almost cardboardy paper, even with pieces of mica in it. It's just a really basic kind of paper, really neat stuff. It might be 50 cents or 3 shillings. I mean, all these representing all these different denominations. And even all the way up to Civil War times, the United States really had no official paper currency in circulation. You think about it. People wanted gold, they wanted silver, and if they couldn't get gold or silver, they would settle for copper, because look, at least when you drop it, it went clink. You had something of substance there. But paper, what's paper? Every time the United States issued paper currency, as they did during the Civil War, the paper would go out being worth, say, a dollar in gold or silver, and then slowly the paper would trade for less until it was totally discounted. You know, the Texas currency from the Republic of Texas that was in circulation in Texas in the 1830s, most of that was eventually redeemed by the state of Louisiana at about 40 cents on the dollar. All these early Texans just losing their shirts because paper, nobody wanted paper. You know, it wasn't like it was today. The United States, during the Civil War, of course, had trouble with gold and silver and having enough in circulation. Private companies and private individuals made their own copper coins and circulated as pennies, at least, that was around. And the United States made fractional currency, 5 cent, 10 cent, 25 cent, 50 cent notes that were kind of small notes, really cool, but they made them again and again and again, trying to get people to accept them, and really they wouldn't do it. And the Confederate States of America made essentially no coins, very, very few coins. They're really rare today. They made lots of different kinds of Confederate currency, but almost all the Confederate currency we see is counterfeit in some way. If you see something that looks like it's supposed to be money and it's on a really thick yellow parchment, well, somebody's trying to take advantage of you. And to my knowledge, even in the 1960s, the General Mills Company issued facsimile copies of Confederate currency in cereal boxes and boxes of Cheerios. Sometimes people bring us a bill, and I say, well, that's counterfeit. They say, how do you know? I say, flip it over. You see where it says facsimile on the bottom? That's from General Mills. And even after the Civil War, lots of different ways the United States tried to get the people to accept money. National currency banknotes that were, although they were printed by government agencies, they were backed by individual banks. and the silver certificates, gold certificates, where you could actually take this money anytime you wanted and redeem it at your local bank for gold or silver that was on deposit there by the federal government. So you had a reason to accept the paper because you could turn it in anytime you wanted for metal, for precious metal. There were interest-bearing notes, legal tender bank notes, which really kind of brings us up to today. You know, until the late 1920s, all the paper money were larger size than they were now. They call them horse blankets. They were so big. Wallets were much bigger than they are now. And in the late 20s, they went to the current small size. Well, what you need to know is that all horse blankets, all of the early 1920 and earlier bills are better, meaning that they all have some value that's higher than just their face value. We bought a large stack of $1, $2, $5, and $10 bills this week, all small size currency, with blue seals and with red seals. We buy that as a courtesy. We pay 25 cents over the face value. Just because
25% over the face value.
20 what?
I've been going 25% over the face value.
Well, for a dollar, that works, but don't do that for a two or a five or ten. Just a quarter over it. It keeps people from spending it. We put it up on our bid board and just let people bid on it. I mean, it's just not rare. You look at the color of the seal on these small bills. If you have a small bill with a green seal on it, well, that's a Federal Reserve note. That's our modern money. Ever since the 1960s, there has been no gold or silver behind these banknotes. They're all Federal Reserve notes, legal tender banknotes. You can't redeem them for anything. But if you have a small note, a note that looks kind of like today's note, but has a brown seal or a yellow seal on it, a gold seal, well, there you might have something. But the old blue seals or the red seals probably are just worth a little more than spending money. And, you know, the blue seal $1 bill, 1935, 1957, the $2 red seal, 1953, 1963. I hope you don't have a stack of those because they're not rare at all.
But the condition always matters. If they're uncirculated and in great condition, they can be better. But most of what we see is all worn out.
So the uncommon notes are the more valuable notes. They're almost always going to be the large size notes. As Adam says, the condition matters. And the vignette, a word that today's guest will be talking about at length, I think. The word vignette. Some of these notes are gorgeous. You know, another area that's very, very interesting, original documents and manuscripts. We had the privilege of handling a large consignment of paper from George Washington Smythe, a signer of the Texas Constitution and U.S. representative to Congress. It was a collection of drafts and notes of speeches he delivered on the topics such as Texas secession from the Union and the place of slavery in Texas, really important historical documents, as well as some personal letters and commercial invoices. That's always fun, reading people's mail. you know, even that entire body of paper eventually sold for under $5,000. You know, if that body of work with that historical import was worth less than $5,000, I mean, really, what's your smelly old stuff worth? That stuff in the garage that the cat's been sleeping in. So, you know, you got to reevaluate what it is that you're cherishing. Postcards can be quite collectible, but not the full-color ones that you see now, and not the linen ones. So when you look at the paper, it looks like it's kind of woven paper. Well, not that. In the postcards, we're looking for something that's different. Where it's really hot are black-and-white photographs of street scenes of old cities with the cars and the people on the street, and the old buildings can be really, really hot. We handled a large collection of wanted cards, prisoner escape cards, from with $15 rewards for kids and $50 rewards for escaped murderers that were sent out to law enforcement agencies. Postcards can be really, really valuable. Mechanical cards, hold-to-light cards, leather and wooden cards can be exciting, but not just old, smelly old cards. You know, ephemera, paper collectibles, can be a great hobby. There's a wide variety of categories. You know, from postcards, old advertising items can be exciting. Ration coupons, which 30 years ago when I started were in everybody's drawer and nobody cared. But now when people see them, they get excited. And rationing coupons from World War II, meat coupons, gasoline coupons, are starting to become a collectible now. Movie posters, even stock and bond certificates, otherwise known as Scripophily, which coincidentally we'll be discussing with our special guest David Astwood from Astwood Collectibles right after this commercial break. We're going to talk to David about his area of expertise and about some other categories of paper that can be collectible. And
last week we sold some Monopoly stock certificates for the different railroads.
That's right.
And I think we had all of them, but Pennsylvania Avenue.
No, we had with the Pennsylvania Railroad. Oh,
we didn't have short.
You know, let's ask
line.
David about it because I know he's a specialist
right.
On this.
We'll come back and talk about that.
There's
a
there's some really cool stuff. You know, KLUP is about to take you away, but we're not going anywhere. You're listening to In the Money with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. Hang in there. We'll be right back. We're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Today's show all about ephemera, paper collectibles. And our guest today, David Astwood, local scripophilist from David Astwood Collectibles. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us on In the Money.
Well, I'm sure glad to be here, Adam. David, it's just a really... fun time just hanging out with you guys and having a chance to visit.
Yeah, it's always a good time to see you, David. Scripophily, I can't believe I said that twice in a row without messing
up. It is
up.
A mouthful.
Yeah, really cool stuff. But before we dive into it, because I want to ask you all about it, we've known you for a while, David, and I know that Scripophily is a part-time passion of yours, mm-hmm. but you have a full-time job, one of the most interesting jobs I've ever heard about. I'm hoping you'll tell us about that.
Well, if anybody's ever wondered who writes those darn tax exams every year, you're talking to the guy right here.
Tax exams?
The tax. I guess they're called STAR now, but I'm one of the writers for the science questions.
Oh, I see. Those are the standardized tests that some people complain
That's
about?
That's what all the high schoolers hate and dread.
Yeah. I never understood that. I think, you know, you have to have some standards to measure people by.
Oh, yes. And really, there's an art in doing that. You know, it, contrary to what many people think, it's not just writing a multiple choice question in 5 minutes and just zinging it through. It takes a lot of time, effort, and you have to really think it through.
Yeah, you mentioned to me once that it can take an hour to actually write one of these multiple choice questions.
Right, and the thing is, you got to make sure your wrong answers are really wrong.
That's,
you don't want someone answering a wrong answer right.
What a good point. And so what qualifies you to write science questions for the standardized test companies?
Well, I have a Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry, mm-hmm. also 2 years of graduate work at the University of Florida. And basically, it just takes having a skill for teaching and knowing your science and being able to think outside the box a little bit.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sitting here with David Astwood, a chemist, and Adam Bluestein, an astrophysicist. And I got a degree in psychology. I feel like a schlub over here.
Hey, Adam and I are buddies. We're science buddies.
But science buddies. Okay, David, Scripophily. What is it and why is it?
Well, Scripophily basically is a financial instrument that was used to represent shares in a company, that which would be called a stock certificate, or to represent a debenture or debt that you have with a company. It's kind of like what we call CDs today at the bank. And many times these certificates that were issued in the past had very interesting designs on it. And you mentioned earlier the beautiful engravings that you see on that.
The vignettes,
exactly. And these are very attractive certificates, and people who collect those are called scripophilists.
And so you mentioned stock and bond certificates. I'm guessing the root of the word is scrip, and my understanding is a scrip is anything that represents money but isn't actually money. Could this? You said stock and bond certificates. It could be like the U.S. savings bonds. Some of those are just beautiful.
Course.
You know, they're
or warrants.
Yeah, there a lot of this merchandise is designed and printed by the Bureau of Engraving and Printing that makes our paper money. And if you've ever been out of the United States for a year or two and saw other people's money and then came back and saw our money, you say, wow, that looks like money. That looks rock solid. And some of the other times, you know, it looks almost like comic strips. But no, right. The Bureau of Engraving and Printing, they've got that nailed. David, cancel checks, vouchers, retail invoices?
Oh, yes, they're canceled checks. I know in some cases you can get some older varieties of the Coca-Cola checks. Not stuff from the 50s or even the 30s. You know, if you go back to the turn of the century, you might have something valuable there. But yes, checks are included. Matter of fact, I bought some Guadalupe County checks recently, and people find those popular. They were issued during the Great Depression.
Yeah, I guess there's no shortage of script. because every place had them.
Yes.
And my experience is that people like the merchandise from near them. But if someone brought us a bunch of stuff from Kansas or Idaho, we'd say, I don't find that
particular. Forgive me if it's kind of a blunt question, but why should people care about scrip?
Well, I do it because I love history. Matter of fact, the slogan I have on my sign is, we sell history one stock at a time.
Nice.
And that's basically why I'm in it. If it's something that doesn't have any real history or culture behind it, to me it just doesn't have much interest. But when I get something from the Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railway, something that ran into Texas back in the late 1800s, and you had Vanderbilt involved.
Neat.
And it has a beautiful vignette on that showing Longhorn cattle and cowboys. You know what? That is sexy.
You know, Adam mentioned the Monopoly stocks before, and I know that last week we sold some of those.
You sold three out of the four.
Three of the four. Now, could you tell our listeners what that means?
Well, guess what? The Short Line Railroad doesn't exist.
But the Reading Railroad,
we just sold
some certificates.
Yes, and the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad.
The B&O Railroad, right.
And the Pennsylvania Railroad.
You know, when I was a kid, I thought that was a joke. The B&O Railroad, ha, ha, ha.
Now, there is a substitute for the Short Line Railroad. There are many collectors to get that complete four. They'll get the... I believe it's the Cleveland Short Line Railroad.
Okay, at least it says Short Line, and people would frame these and hang them in their offices. And I know that they issued some of these certificates again and again, different formats, different colors, different vignettes, just beautiful
stuff.
Well,
that's what makes it really fun, because there's so many varieties.
Well, you know, would you consider it a hobby? I mean, I can tell that, you know, of course, that you're excited about it, or... also an avocation, right?
Well, I tell you what, it really is a fascinating hobby. I know some people, they get burned out on collecting coins and even paper money. And then you introduce to them scripophily, these old stock certificates, and they say, wow, I never even considered that area.
Interesting you say that. I mean, I've been a coin dealer for a long time, and frankly, I got tired of George Washington's head a long time ago. Since 1932, we've been looking at that head on the quarters. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I have an interest in specialty, and I collect things that you just don't see every day. And so there's some thrill of the hunt, and you find some things that you're just not used to and bored with.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that I just recently bid on was the Palmer Oil Union Company. And if you're not familiar with that, it was you probably heard of the gentleman who went to a yard sale and bought a stock certificate and now is trying to stick Coca-Cola with a bill for a few million dollars.
Well, I didn't hear about that. And how is that possible?
Well, evidently the back of the certificate wasn't signed, and there was an area, I guess, for the recipient to sign that. And his whole idea is it wasn't signed on the back, therefore I should be able to collect the value of the certificate.
His position then had never been redeemed.
Right.
And that company was bought out by Coca-Cola.
Actually, it was like the grandfather
of Coca-Cola.
For Coca-Cola, because it was bought out by another company, then Coca-Cola bought out the company that bought that company.
And as the share price rose and the company split, he got that certificate represented more and more shares, and Wow, that could be something.
So I actually ended up bidding and buying the actual Palmer Union certificates, the actual one that was actually being redeemed and is in court right now as we speak.
But yours but mine's
have been canceled.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
You have been redeemed.
You know, our regular listeners know that last week's In the Money program was about dealing small. We talked about the principles of limiting your overhead, narrow focus, and our favorite, flip for quick turnover. How do you get your merchandise in front of potential buyers while keeping your overhead low?
Well, I tell you what, you really have to study your buyers. You know, to say, well, I can't understand why no one's buying my stuff and getting mad and walking away is not going to work.
And I hear that and I see that all the time, as if it's the customer's fault.
It's not their fault. You got to figure out what they want. You know, one thing when I'm purchasing merchandise, I will not buy stock certificates without a vignette. Why? Because every customer I have says, oh, I want something that looks nice to post on my wall, you know. I want something that looks good.
Because I'm imagining there are some serious collectors who want the piece for the technical value, but
right.
most people, it's art.
99% of people want it for the art.
And you said, what your customers want. Who are your customers?
Well, my customers, I actually sell through you. I have consignments through Jewelry Exchange and Auction.
And another,
really good.
I know you consign to other dealers and auction houses.
Right,
too.
And I sell at the two gun shows here in town, the Saxon Gun Show and the San Antonio Gun Show. I have a table there.
Well, tell me, why would you sell Scripofili at a gun show?
Well, because a lot of people who come to gun shows like to collect guns. And if they have that collector's instinct, that may bleed over to the other things. And I've noticed that at gun shows for quite a while, you have coin or numismatic dealers selling coins and different types of currency, and that's very popular.
And when I was younger and I had the energy, I did an awful lot of shows. And I liked to be the guy who had the stuff that nobody else had.
Right.
A
niche.
I'd like to take coins to an antique show, and I'd like to take jewelry to a coin show.
Right.
And I think to bring stock certificates and bonds to a gun show, for very many of the people walking around are accompanied by somebody, often a spouse, who just doesn't want to be there, and they're sick of the whole thing. And this gives them something else to look at and somebody else to talk to.
Well, the neat thing is I see people stop at my table and they say, wow, this is the most interesting table in the show.
I've never
seen this before.
That's cool.
And then the next time they come, they may be interested in purchasing something.
So you're doing shows, and is that the main way then, you besides consigning to other dealers, that's the main way
you get your merchandise
in front of people?
I sell a little bit my coin clubs, too.
Are you doing anything on eBay or any kind of internet selling?
Well, no eBay or internet selling this time because I'm just doing it on the weekends.
True, you got a job.
I got a real job.
What kind of cost is associated with having a table at the gun show?
Cost anywhere from $65 to $70 for an 8-foot table.
And that's for usually 2 days, right?
For a 2-day show, which is very reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, talk about keeping your overhead down.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just didn't want to go or you didn't have any merchandise to sell, you just wouldn't have to pay for a table.
You know, it'll cost $5 or $7, $10 just to get in the door, just to be a customer. So really, when you think about it, it's very, very low level investment.
Yeah, that works.
And so you just put your merchandise in the car and drive on over there and plop it down on the table,
right.
Try to make it look attractive. And as far as attracting buyers and customers, I think it's the responsibility of the show to bring in the customers.
Right.
And if they don't,
well, then you just find another place to go.
Nobody's going to come anymore. The dealers won't
come. Right.
They
need to be advertising on television, getting the billboards put up, and letting people know that we're there.
And so it's a low-cost way to go out and do business with very little responsibility.
It really is. And I would just urge anybody who's into collecting, that is just really the way to go, to get a shop and to do the brick-and-mortar thing. That really is
It's expensive.
It's
I'll
expensive.
Attest to that. And you're obligated to show up. Adam and I work 8 or 9 days a week, and boy, you know, that it's an old joke my father taught me. He said that when you own your own business, you only have to work half days, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, half days, and that's certainly what it feels like. At these shows, are you offering other merchandise or just your certificates?
Yes, that's one of the lessons I learned early on. You have to have variety. Because you may have people coming to the show by the thousands, but if only one person in 1,000 is interested in stock certificates, well, you may want to have some other stuff, like some junk boxes where they can go through and look for foreign coins to give their kids. Or I have some ceramic beer steins that I put out, which are popular.
I've seen some rock samples at your table.
Oh,
as
yes.
Well.
Also, I'll sell some amethyst and citrine mineral samples from Brazil. It's just all to get someone to just stop at your table and say, hey, I think that's interesting.
Well, you know, we talk a lot to small dealers. In fact, I feel that we mentor a lot of small dealers, and we always encourage them to develop a narrow focus, because we see people who, with no particular experience in some categories, going out and spending a lot of money because maybe they can make money on Beanie Babies, and maybe Barrettes will sell well this week. And before they know it, the money's all gone. So we're always saying narrow in, but you're saying you got to spread out a little bit.
Well, you have to keep it within reason. The reason why I do sell rocks and minerals, I was a rock hound for many years. So I know the stuff that people like in the area of rocks and minerals. And I really try to keep it in an area which represents history. If it doesn't have any historical value, I stay out of that. And also remember, I have to have stuff that I can fit on my 8-foot table.
Yeah, that's right. You got to fill up the table. That's
no antique furniture.
So you don't do furniture, right?
That's right. And the price range, what's your price point?
Well, I tell you what, cheap sells right now.
Yeah.
People, with the economy and everything, it's very difficult to take a $200 item and just sell it off the table real quick. You have to be patient. But, you know, just about every person who comes by the table, they have a dollar and they can buy 5 coins for their kids.
You know, we always invite people to say none of your business when we ask some of these questions. But we'd like to get into the technical aspect of this. Mm-hmm. We want our listeners to see our industry, or the industry of buying and selling almost anything, from the inside out. So mm-hmm. we ask questions about costs and overhead. And I want to talk to you about your typical profit margin. We know that retail jewelers will keystone or double keystone, mm-hmm. meaning mark up 100% to 200%. We know that the bullion deals we do, in order to be competitive, we better not try to make more than 2%, mm-hmm. or people will just go elsewhere. What kind of profit margins are possible in the scripophily business?
Right. Well, I tell you what, it's really important to learn the difference between wholesale and retail. When I first started out in the business, I was just going on eBay and saying, hey, this is cool, and I'd just buy that. And I'd pay $5 or $6 for it, and then I'd find out that's just about all I can sell it for.
Right, or more.
Or more. And so basically I was very fortunate in that I found a scripophily dealer in Europe who would sell stuff, wow. You know, 10 or 20 certificates at a time, and I could pick them up for anywhere from 50 cents to $2 each.
And you're saying that this scripophilist in Europe,
yes.
is able to provide you with, is it U.S.-based material?
U.S.-based material and also some foreign every once in a while.
Well, where in the world would he get it?
Well, he's a major dealer in Europe. And as a matter of fact, I think scripophily is a little bit more popular in Europe right mm-hmm. now. They bought a lot of our debt back during the early days of the country, and they have a lot of paper over there.
A lot of matured paper that right. they may or may not have collected.
Right.
And so, okay, you have your merchandise for sale, you're shooting for your profit margin, and as we all know, after a while, some things you just get sick of looking at it. Our average is no more than 10 days for a piece of merchandise till it's gone. It's just gone. If you come in looking for it, oh, sir, lady, that's gone. And so talk to me about that. At what point do you say, okay, I've had it with this piece?
Well, I have a prime example there of the Avon cologne bottles that you all kind of had a little chuckle about.
Well, don't blame me on that. You bid on that. We close out estates for people, and we don't like to say to people, well, look, we'll take that, but no, we're going to stick you with that. We say, okay, bring it, and let us sell it for you. And so sometimes we put it in bins.
Well, what happened was...
And sometimes people buy bins.
That's what I did.
And sometimes they're named David Astwin.
Well, I figured I actually tripled my money on those Avon cologne bottles, and I said to myself, you know what, why do I want to keep lugging these around? So a guy comes to my table, and I said, how would you like the deal of the century? Everything in this box for $20, take it away. And the guy's face lit up, and I wrapped all those things, and he was the happiest camper.
Cool. Now, you mentioned that some of your merchandise you get from your guy in Europe, and we know that some of it you buy at auction. Where else do you get it from?
Well, eBay is a big thing, too. I love eBay because a lot of the sellers, sometimes they'll put stuff up, and 99 times out of 100, they will overprice it. They'll think, oh, it's old. Right. It's got to be worth $30 or $40. And I'm saying, oh. But sometimes I'll see something like the Palmer Oil Certificates, and I know that's going to be a sleeper because most people don't know the name of the company. They just know about Coca-Cola.
And you have some specialized knowledge.
And I have some special knowledge there, and I know, hey, this could be a real sleeper. I could use that. And the person who was selling it probably didn't know too much about it, didn't even mention Coca-Cola in his description on eBay. So I put my bid in, and I got those.
Right. You know, we did a show a few weeks ago about eBay and about how to do proper searches on eBay, and I encourage anybody who feels encouraged by what David's saying about going onto eBay and looking for merchandise, collectibles, to listen to our show on the InTheMoneyRadio.com website about eBay, because we tell you the only way to search on eBay. We'll have people come in and say, I saw three of them sell on eBay, and we'll go look and see it was the same piece posted three times by the same guy who still was unable to sell it because right. He's just asking too darn much for it.
That's a common problem.
Yeah, it's a common problem. We just like to move that merchandise. I don't want to be caught kicking a dead horse at one of our auctions.
And so, David, I know very little about script, and so if I wanted to learn more about it, do you have any books or any reference materials that you would recommend?
I think the primary source I would say for you to get is the Standard Catalog of Stocks and Bonds by Colin R. Bruce. It's put out by Krauss Publications.
Well, Krauss is a big publisher
big
of coin and currency guidebooks.
Well, they have the same type of thing for stock certificates, although be aware it's extremely limited. There's zillions
right.
of stock certificates out there, so you're going to see basically the most common types that are in here.
Tell me, I can see you have a passion for this. Do you collect script yourself?
No, actually, I don't. I said to myself, you know, if I'm going to run a business, I'm going to have to sell this stuff, not say, oh, I can't sell this. I'm going to have to keep this.
Yeah, don't get emotionally
involved. You just can't do that.
I wear no jewelry whatsoever. Adam wears his wedding ring. I don't like to wear a wedding ring because it gets in the way when I go to bars.
Uh-oh. You know?
I do collect Colonial Canadian tokens, so if anybody likes those, talk to me.
David, advice for a newbie?
Know what you're buying first. I had a gentleman come to the gun show, and he was just so excited. He had all these stock certificates that he thought were worth a lot of money. Turned out it was the stuff that you could buy on eBay for a buck or two.
Gotcha.
Just very common. So look for a nice vignette. Look for some age, and look for something that's esoteric, something that's not common.
So, and something that excites you. I found that if it excites me, it'll excite other people
right.
when I'm ready to
Especially
sell.
Especially the railroads. That's really good.
We're going to take a short commercial break now. Then we'll return to open up the phone lines here on In the Money with our special guest, David Astwood from David Astwood Collectibles, and Adam and me, David Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction and co-host of KLUP's In the Money. Every Saturday evening, thousands of people just like you join our live auctions in Stone Oak. New and estate jewelry at up to 80% off retail, including brand names like Tiffany, Rolex, and James Avery. Rare coins and currency far below coin shop prices. And name your own price for all sorts of collectibles and small antiques with different merchandise every week. Bid live in the gallery or through our internet simulcast and never pay retail again. It's all happening at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction each Saturday in San Antonio. Texas license number 16604. Member Better Business Bureau. Call 210-592-8786 or visit jewelryexchangeandauction.com. That's jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And join us every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. for In the Money right here on KLU.
You're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Today we're talking to David Astwood, local scribophilist from David Astwood Collectibles. We're talking about stocks and bond certificates and paper collectibles in general. I know that we've received some emails this week, people that wanted to ask David a question. Adam, you have some questions from our listeners?
I certainly do. Clint asks, many years ago, I invested in Iraqi currency.
Oh, boy.
Someone told me that when the government changes, the value of the money will dramatically increase. What is it worth now?
Well, I would say, just with all due respect here, it's probably not going to be worth what you think.
Right.
The problem with that is a number of servicemen coming back from Iraq had that exact same thought. So you have a lot of that stuff out there. I can go to any coin shop here in town, and I can say, hey, do you have any Iraqi currency with Saddam Hussein on it? And they're going to bring out a whole dish full of those notes.
So it's not very valuable.
It's just not very valuable. The thing is, if you get a good idea and you think, wow, this might be collectible, then probably someone else is thinking the same thing and hoarding it.
And frankly, it's a great resource, eBay. When I first heard about this, not that I thought that they'd become valuable because of the strength of the currency. I thought maybe it was something that could be marketed because obviously people were interested. Mm-hmm. So I went and took a look on eBay and I saw that everybody and his brother was selling these mm-hmm. notes. And I think 1 million dinar packets. And they were like $250, $290. But when you did the math, you're thinking, oh, man, that's pretty steep. The dinar would have to go through the roof before you could even begin to get your money back. And I've been in just about every shop in town while someone came yes. in and offered to sell that merchandise, and everybody shakes their head and says, no interest.
And the problem is when there is a regime change, they don't use the same money. They demonetize the old money and then just reissue new money.
Right.
So that guarantees that your money will go to zero.
Has right. never happened in the United States, but look at Mexico many, many times. Adam, we have time maybe for one more question?
Yeah, I've got another question. Michelle asks, is the United States going back to the gold standard?
You know, I just read today that there is veiled talk in the Republican platform
yes.
to actually have a commission to look at that. You can make the case. And I heard someone say recently, well, that's stupid. Of course we had to go off the gold standard. But what does that mean? Of course we had to drive the car off the cliff? I don't understand that. I kind of like the idea. And besides, you know, Dave Ramsey, I think most people know who Dave Ramsey is.
Mm-hmm.
First thing he says is rip up those credit cards. And why don't you just don't buy things that you can't afford? So are we going back on it? Almost impossible at this point. Is it a good idea? I think it's you could have mm-hmm. a good debate about that. And I think the good idea would have been never to have gone off of it. But I don't know how you get back on the train after you got drunk and fell off. Oh, no, we're out of time for the week. Our thanks to David Aswood from David Aswood Collectibles for joining us here. We'll be back next Saturday at 7 a.m. with our new program, Step by Step. We'll take you step by step through a typical jewelry transaction at the Jewelry Exchange. We want you to know how it works. Our guest, Michael Tanguma, the newest member of our team at the Jewelry Exchange, his first time on the radio. If you have questions about selling your jewelry or anything else, call us at the Jewelry Exchange, 210-592-8786, or email your questions to questions@inthemoneyradio.com. We'll answer every question. The best ones we'll answer on the air. We hope to see you tonight at our live auction at the Jewelry Exchange in Stone Oak at 7 o'clock. And we hope you'll join us again next week for In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Thanks for joining us this morning, and have a great week.